session number 23378, reel 8.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Phil Roden in his home in Melbourne, Victoria, on the 14th of the 5th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Phil, you were mentioning on the previous tape that the Japanese had indicated that they would attack Australia. How had that made itself known?
I don't know, it would have come through the usual channels to the higher commands. By this time, of course, MacArthur was in Australia and he knew everything, and all sources, all things flow through MacArthur. And I suppose it came down the channels in that way, that they would prefer to get a footing in Moresby and Milne Bay before attacking Australia. They couldn't, and they would attack Australia between Townsville and Brisbane. The locals at first were apprehensive, and then they embraced us as heroes coming back from the Middle East to save them. They seemed to have an open mind as to if war was going to be fought on their land. A bit like the Arabs, in a sense. They went out with their ploughs to get greater compensation. But I know that's wrong. They were apprehensive. Of course, we're coming up to the time when the Coral Sea battle took place, which indicated that the things were getting earnest so far as Australia was concerned.
We're talking May 5th.
Yep.
It had lasted for 3 days. What had you heard about that particular battle?
Nothing while it was taking place. We only heard afterwards it occurred, and that it was a sort of victory that we had. Fought by aeroplanes, largely out of carriers.
Had you heard a couple of weeks after that of the Japanese midget subs entering Sydney Harbour? 31st of May.
Not immediately, that filtered through later.
What was the feeling then, that they'd sort of bypassed the Brisbane line almost?
Well, there are only midget submarines. Well, that caused some damage, about 17 sailors, I think, had been. The fact that they'd infiltrated the Sydney Harbour was a great concern to everyone, but they didn't think it pressed that major attack of any kind. The fact that they got there was disturbing enough when it became known. That, when you add it to the Darwin bombing and the Broome and other towns in the north, they knew that the game was on for young and old.
This time you would have been undertaking training. What did that involve?
Well, the training was the best training I've ever had. Weapon training and fitness training, walking through the hills, going out on long exercises. We were pretty fit by the time we pushed off. We had a wonderful bonding under the new CO, and different appointments had been made. And I was, for example, now head quarter company commander, which is going up the scale a bit in the scheme of things. Personally, very satisfying, and we were a strong, great unit by the time we left. The locals had embraced us so much so that many of them would have been married and settled up in that area.
How would your duties change in relation to your promotion?
I didn't get promotion by way of rank until later, but the appointment was the great thing. I had under me all the specialist units of the battalion, like signallers, carriers, transport, mortars, machine guns, all the specialist things. The wide pioneers, the wide variety of the command meant that I had, in a sense, a far busier time. I was embracing so many things. It was a good appointment. And without all those specialist arms and specialist things going well in the battalion, if they didn't go well, it caused problems. And you're higher up the scale of consultation too, which is a good thing.
What sorts of things were you privy to that others, and yourself included, previously would not have been privy to?
Well, perhaps what the Brigadier was thinking, what the CA himself was thinking. You were consulted about things that normally you might not be consulted. You were sort of a listening device for this. I don't mean spy on other people, I mean you were there for him to consult. And you felt he could trust. Because the CA is a very lonely person. Very lonely. He's only got his 2IC and then the headquarters company command, perhaps his adjutant. Perhaps he's an RMO, sometimes a padre. The AC of the headquarter company has got a lot of knowledge to be consulted about. Gets into the senior officer group in the battalion.
Can we talk a little bit about Brigadier Potts? And you mentioned loneliness for someone like him. Did he ever sort of appear to be a lonely sort of man?
Potsy was a World War I soldier, decorated, a farmer down the southwest of Western Australia. Looked well, in uniform, a ruddy face, moustache. Knowledgeable, understood men, was at home talking with them. He's what you might call a good Australian. The men liked him, even though many of them wouldn't have spoken to him. They had an image of him which was good. They trusted him. They trusted him, knowing full well that his professional knowledge was great and he'd apply it to the best use. He not only had the rank, but he had the status of being a good commander. It's one thing to have rank, another thing to use it wisely. We couldn't have had a better person to take us into what was to come.
What would have been your first encounter with him?
In the Middle East. Possibly at Latani. I just don't recall exactly, but would be at the Middle East, I would have known him. Only remotely, of course. He wasn't a brigadier then. But when he became a brigadier here, you got to know him a bit closer because of functions in the mess and perhaps in the field.
So when you met him again, at closer hand, closer quarters, how was his impression that you had gained of him in the Middle East to size up with reality of who he was?
Oh, my admiration for him, my belief in him, and my trust in him grew immensely. The more you knew him, the more you knew that he was certain that you had a good man there. Brigadier is an important person in the brigade. He's probably got three COs of the three battalions who are totally different people. Some are quiet and reserved, others are outgoing. Others are midway between. They're not the same people, the three of them. Totally different. Consequently, their battalions are probably totally different. But if you have a bad brigadier, you've really got problems. Now, he was popular. In a good sense, and as I've said, everyone trusted him.
You mentioned that you might hear more information as a result of your position. When was it that you were to hear about, for instance, where you might be sent off to? And New Guinea, obviously. When was it that you started to hear that that would be a reality?
We were told that we were going to move from our prison location at Yandina on the 4th of August. On the 6th of August we were on the James Fenimore Cooper, U.S. Liberty ship in Brisbane on the 6th.
The Japanese had landed in the Gona area on the 21st of July. Had you been aware of this? Had you been, for instance, privy to this knowledge?
We heard that they had landed, yes. No details. However, we sailed up through the Great Barrier Reef and northwards. Other ships and the convoy had joined us. We were unescorted. And we saw, as we got past Cape York, one of the ships turn to the east. That later turned out to be the 18th Brigade going to Milne Bay. We realised as we got past Australia that we were certainly going further. We thought we were just going up north, and at various definitions. And as we passed each place, or thought we were passing each place, we ticked them off. That's gone, that's gone. And we realised we're going off to New Guinea. So we reached on the 12th of August. July, August, August, August.
Tell us then your initial experience of arrival, your impressions of the place.
Well, first thing we knew we were in a war zone, there was a wreck in the Moresby Harbour, a ship called the MacDewey, still there actually, and we realised the Japanese bombers had been over Moresby before, and they would have come later, of course. The ship couldn't pull alongside the wharf because the drafts were wrong. The corvette ferried us to waiting tracks, and then for 26 miles we pulled up a narrow road with S-bends and American drivers, black, who drove as if they were bit like tippo drivers, they drove hard, going around these bends, and you look down and saw nothing but gaps in the geography of the place. Finally we got up to a place called Kuitaki, which is, and you could see the base of the mountains rising into the sky and into the clouds. By that time, we soon knew that we were off to be off and going. First thing we realised that the battalion would be cut down from about 800 or 900 people, getting rid of our transport. They're on their feet, getting rid of our carriers, our mortars, our machine guns. We realised very quickly we had 4 days between the 12th and the 16th when we started walking, and all these things were happening. We realised we had to carry everything, food, ammunition, clothing, etc., on our backs. Nothing else would go any other way. So that meant experimenting with what we needed to take. Even toothbrushes were cut in half. And it was a very sparse body of people that left off on the 16th.
Had you heard anything of the 39th Battalion at all?
We knew that they were up there, sparring with the Japs. We didn't know the extent to which they were committed, or they were having their problems in getting into the firing line, so to speak. We knew that we were going towards Kokoda when we started walking. We didn't know what was in store for us, both physically and also from a battle point of view. We knew that we were going to take Kokoda and drive the Japanese out.
What had been the reputation of the 39th up until this time, do you think?
Well, the 39th, we didn't know it.
I was asking you, sorry, what had been the reputation of the 39th up until this point?
Well, they were a militia battalion, recruited very hurriedly in December of the previous year. But they were doing a good job. They'd been flown in piecemeal, and had been in contact with the Japanese since the 21st of July when they landed. Only piecemeal in the first instance by a company called, which a fellow called Templeton, a First World War bloke, was in command of, and he did a very good job in sparring with the Japanese until they reached Kokoda itself. The 39th were driven from the Kokoda back to a place called Ishirawa. And as I say, they were young people, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, without previous experience, without much training. But they had a good spirit. And they did as much as they could. And we were to see them at first hand, of course, a few days later when we reached the Ishirawa. But perhaps more of that later.
So you had 4 days basically to prepare for the march over the Owen Stanley.
Yeah.
What sort of contact did you have with your men, and what sorts of discussions did you have with your men before you actually took off up the Golden Staircase, as it was known?
On board ship, I'd become second in command of the battalion, still a captain. the previous second command had been moved before we left Australia. So it was a matter of moving around, talking to the fellows, listening to their ideas of how to cut down material, their packs and things, how best to carry them, discussing about what weapons would be taken and what would be used, discussing about the future. But what we didn't know was the track. We didn't know what we were up for and the physical exertions involved in getting into battle. But we were talking about what we knew about the Japanese. It was a very crowded period, very crowded indeed.
What sort of advice did the men in the battalion ask of you?
Well, they asked about what we knew about the Japanese. They'd ask us if we thought it was a good idea to not take X or not take Y or take A and B instead, or would it be best to put it up there instead of down here, and so on and so forth. The whole thing was a new development for them.
What would you say have been their primary concern at this point?
Be well equipped to take the right weapons in order to fight a very clever and well equipped Japanese who'd had great success quickly in reaching that point, that they were going to fight in a new environment completely, of which they had no real experience. Because in Australia, when we happened at Yandina, away we went into the bush. It was not jungle bush. New tactics of which they had no experience. So on the 16th off we marched. Rather like going into local parklands for a start, but it quickly emerged that it was something quite different.
How much equipment would you say each man was carrying?
45 pounds at least. Too much for a white man to carry, we were told. In addition, they had their rifles and or Bren guns and or Tommy guns, grenades, 45 pounds on their back. Superhuman effort to get there with that. But they got there.
When was the first point that you realised things weren't going to be as straightforward as you had planned or hoped?
After day one, when we found that the track was enemy number one for a while, pulling your feet out of mud and getting wet at night, drying out for an hour or two during the day and getting wet and cold again as we got up and up. And as we found out that once you got to one hill you had to go down to get up the next. Up and down like a roller coaster. It didn't go as fast. No sense of the enemy attacking you in the early stage, only the bloody track.
What were the immediate troubles that you were to experience in relation to the tropical climate, in relation to things associated with the tropics? Not just the weather, possibly.
Well, the diseases you get, the mites that are around, the bites you get.
How quickly did they start to affect?
All at once. It's remarkable the fortitude with which they met all these problems. Malaria wasn't a consequence, nor was dysentery. Scrub typhus wasn't a consequence until later on. But jungle diseases quickly took over, and as I mentioned earlier this afternoon, the casualties 3-1, and not much was known, of course, about these diseases so far as Australia was concerned. You could only get one person along the track. You couldn't march two side by side. And that meant that we were committed piecemeal to battle when we arrived. We walked, it's like if you can imagine a cricket ground, going through the gate, the turnstiles. And instead of pausing for a moment in the dressing room, you had to immediately walk out into the field and start playing. That's what happened. That's disconcerting, to say the least.
The stairway, initially, how difficult were they to handle?
The Golden Stairs, they were in day two of the approach march between Newbury and Yorubawa. They were straight up, they put in logs of wood to cause a step, and they were supported by a piece of wood hammered down, they put in by engineers. Firstly, the steps were wider than the normal step should be. The next step was higher than it was normal to put your foot onto. And with the traffic and the weather and the rain and so on, they got muddy on the flat step, which meant that you had to have two goes at most steps, and 1,000 of them. And your foot went in, and in order to get out, to get up, you had to pull yourself up, and the whole thing was a hell of a business. I can remember towards the finish of the march, day two, with the RMO going backwards and forwards over the last 100 yards, perhaps more really, encouraging the last few people to finish off, telling them a few fibs that there's only a little way to go, but there was more than that when you multiplied it by the number of yards to go, by the number of exertions to go. But they made it. And I was buggered, and so was the RMO to finish.
What sort of difficulty did you have in convincing your men, given the fact that you were in this exhausted state?
Well, you can only lead by example. That's what we did. They could see that we were doing it, and they would do it too. They saw that most of the battalions had done it too. They weren't going to let themselves down. We seemed to be offside in any way. Such was the spirit we had built up.